Your brain needs support, and new Ollie Brainy Chews are a delightful way to take care of your cognitive health. Made with scientifically backed ingredients like Thai ginger, L-theanine, and caffeine, Brainy Chews support healthy brain function and help you find your focus, stay chill, or get energized. Be kind to your mind and get these nootropic chews at Ollie.com. That's Olly.com. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
The Merrill Report is recorded in front of a live virtual audience on the Duck Pond. Tuesday nights, 9 p.m. Eastern, live. Mallard.com. MALLIARD.com. One more thing before we start. Let me turn it over to my friend that you may know from Ancient Aliens and the Curse of Oak Island and many other things, Robert Clotworthy.
On the Mallard Report, the views, thoughts, and opinions expressed on the show are solely those of the hosts and guests and not necessarily of Evergreen Podcasts, KillerPodcast.com, sponsor or affiliate, or any other individual or group. On the Mallard Report, the views, thoughts, and opinions expressed in the show are solely those of the hosts and guests and not necessarily of Evergreen Podcasts, KillerPodcast.com, sponsor or affiliate, or any other individual or group.
Good evening. I hope everybody's well. Let's get into this ad read here. Three strangers moving in different directions find themselves in a small town in the middle of Ohio, a force reeling them in like a needle drawn on a compass to the north, powerless to stray away from the impending convergence. They must take a stand in the battle versus good, or in the battle of good and evil. But what happens when the worst evil wears the face of good? Life of Blood is a macabre tale of freedom, love, and being human. A must-read novel from Daniel Belts, coming out February 6th. He'll be on the Mallard Report in February as well. So be looking forward to hearing more about that. My guest tonight is Dr. Gregory Sheehan, is the leading authority in near-death experiences and afterlife across cultures throughout history. Gregory is the author of numerous books, but including the most recent one, The Next World of Extraordinary Experiences of the Afterlife. I'm not even going to read. You've got so many degrees here. They're listed for me to read to you, but I feel like this. When I said he is the leading authority, he's got 4 or 5 degrees here. I'm just going to welcome you to the program. Greg, how are you? Gregory, how are you doing tonight?
I am good, thanks, Jim. How are you? Thanks for having me on.
Man, where did you come up for air getting all these degrees?
Well, yeah, good question. No, I've been lucky. I've kind of found this really interesting area of research to pursue, and just kind of knuckled down and did it one after another.
We've been going back and forth about the frame of the interview and how this all goes, but I want to make sure we talk about the book first, and then we're gonna obviously dive into all this content, the content and the subject matter. So tell me about the next world. Extraordinary Experiences of the Afterlife. Let's get there first.
Okay. Yeah, my first two books were, heavy academic books, and they were written for an academic audience, published by Bloomsbury and then Oxford University Press. And even though I wrote them with regular readers in mind, and I think that anybody could read them, they're kind of marketed to academic audiences, which means for the previous book, $110 price tag. So a lot of people are interested in near-death experiences, and when people hear about that there's historical and cross-cultural examples of them, they want to read more and learn about it. So I got tired of people saying, yeah, but you can't buy my book because it's $110. So I thought I'd write like an accessible synthesis of it, looking at the idea from all different kinds of cultures and religions and different kinds of histories around the world that was not only accessible to people as far as the academic language and everything goes, but price-wise as well. It's like a normally priced paperback. So yeah, just really kind of wanting to make my work accessible and get it out there a little to a wider audience.
So take me back. What started you down this whole journey to start with?
I've always been interested in unusual phenomena, I hesitate to use words like paranormal, but whatever we want to call them. Ever since I was a kid, really, I had a book called Phenomenon. It had rains of frogs and fishes and things like somebody found a live frog inside of a lump of coal in England in 1742, and all this kind of stuff. And for one thing, the historical examples fascinated me most for whatever reason. And then for another thing, the supernatural stuff, the life after death related stuff, particularly did. And even within that, it was near death experiences that I when I first read about them, I thought, you know, what? People are clinically dead for a while and then they come back and remember having these kinds of experiences. It just kind of, you know, it blew my youthful mind. But then later on, you know, I didn't pursue it academically or professionally or anything. I just kind of lodged it away in the back of my mind. But when I was doing my first degree, which was actually in Egyptian archaeology, I was reading afterlife texts like the Book of the Dead and the coffin texts and pyramid texts, and just started kind of noticing that there were a lot of similarities between what the ancient Egyptians believed happened in the afterlife and happened when somebody died and went there in comparison to the near-death experience. So, for example, leaving the body, entering darkness, coming out into a realm of light, meeting a being of light who assists you in your you know, evaluation of your previous life, even a strange kind of encounter with a person's own corpse, because it was a sort of symbolic version of this in ancient Egypt, where the dead person is associated with the god Osiris, who's the god of the underworld, and part of the afterlife journey involves encountering the corpse of Osiris in the other realm, and that realization that that corpse is basically one and the same as your dead body on Earth is what enables the spirit to proceed into the next level of the afterlife. And obviously the being of light is the sun god, Ray. So it's all kind of symbolically expressed themes of near-death experiences. At least that's how I kind of interpreted it at the time.
So I've got to ask this question because I'm morbid, I guess. So sure. The spirit has to encounter the body. So we're leaving the bodies lay around so the spirit can find them?
Yeah, so, you know, when contemporary NDEs, the kind that you know most people are aware of, people often describe that they rise out of the body in the operating room after they've had a heart attack or in the street after they've been hit by a car or whatever, and they look down and they see their dead body lying there, and they think, well, they think two things. One of them is, you know, oh my God, I'm outside of my body, I must be still alive, but I've survived my consciousness has survived the death of my physical body. So there's that realization, which then, you know, allows them to accept the reality of what's happening to them. But then there's the other feeling of like, what is that horrid alien thing there? I do not want to get back into it. And that kind of inspires them to, you know, to proceed into whatever afterlife experience they're going to have. And so that was kind of symbolically expressed in the ancient Egyptian texts, I think.
That's fascinating to think about, that they had a mechanism to even describe that, because we're having a hard time talking about it now.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I should say that, you know, on some level, this is my interpretation in light of near-death experience, because the ancient Egyptians didn't have texts where they said, you know, this guy Imhotep or whatever died last week and he came back to life and this is what he told us. They just didn't use writing for like these kinds of personal narratives or journalism or whatever. So it's kind of speculative. And partly because of that, I wanted to do a comparison of afterlife beliefs in different ancient civilizations. So I compared ancient Egyptian to ancient India, Mesopotamia, China, and Aztec and Mayan Mesoamerican cultures. So most of them actually had some kind of references to near-death experiences showing that they at least knew about them. A few of them, especially China, there's one from Mesopotamia, one from Mesoamerica, they actually had these kind of supposedly documentary accounts of NDEs, which kind of suggested to me that their afterlife beliefs were at least to some extent influenced by them, if not totally inspired by them.
So, around the world, because you, like you said, you mentioned studying this, is it more acceptable, I guess, for the lack of a better word on my part, to have these experiences or talk about these experiences? I'm sure there are places that are very guarded and don't talk about that.
For sure, yeah. In fact, America in the 20th and 21st century is one of them. I mean, Western contemporary society is pretty, you know, has a real death phobia. People are weirded out by the subject still. And a lot of people who have NDEs even now are afraid to talk about them because people are going to think that they're crazy or woo-woo New Age weirdos or whatever. So they just keep it to themselves. But yeah, I think in a lot of other cultures throughout history and even in modern times, near-death experiences are greeted in a much more open and accepting sort of way. And they're I wouldn't say they're normal. They're not a normalized thing. They're always seen as extraordinary and amazing and wonderful. But they're treated as a more positive sort of thing. And people are believed. I think that's the essential point to make, that people would actually be believed when they came back and talked about these things.
This is exactly what I was telling you about before we got on air. Germantown Runner has a question for me, which I didn't even cross my mind, but somehow he pulls one out that makes me look like an idiot, which is fair. He's allowed to do that. He's good at it. Have you had a near-death experience, or somebody close to you had a near-death experience?
I haven't, no. No, and I don't even think anybody close to me has. My dad had deathbed vision experience, and the distinction there is that the person who's dying sees visions of deceased relatives or spirits or whatever coming to them. He wasn't like in some other realm. So that was an interesting and unusual experience because he had what they call terminal lucidity, where he was essentially in a coma for something like 12 days, and he hadn't, you know, obviously been communicative. And he suddenly sits up and sees his mother and says, "Mama." And then he's talking about, you know, other experiences that he had remembered in his life. He had been a musician, so he's remembering concerts that he played. And this is all after, you know, you would not expect him to be able to come back and do this sort of thing. But that was after I'd already started exploring this kind of stuff. So as far as a personal dimension goes, I guess there's not a major element of that other than, you know, maybe a slightly odd preoccupation with.
Well, trust me, I get it. I get it.
Yeah.
The questions that most people don't like to ask are the ones I love to ask, so I get the interesting part of it.
Yeah, and a lot of people just think, you know, well, how can you study death all the time, and isn't this morbid and depressing? And to me, it's not at all, because it's not studying, I don't know, the morphology of corpse decay.
I was going to say, there are a lot more death things that I could think of that would be less sunshine and rainbows, I guess.
Yeah, so... And because of the fact that it's cross-cultural, it's always, you know, kind of re-inspiring my interest in it, because there's always a new culture to learn about, you know, what they think about death and the afterlife and NDEs. And because of the fact that NDEs have been, it's almost like this hidden undercurrent throughout history, because of that, to try to find them and tease them out from these either ancient texts or anthropological texts is quite a challenge. They weren't even named until 1975 with Raymond Moody. You know, he came up with the term near-death experience. And before that, most cultures didn't have any word for them. So it's just kind of searching out accounts of people who died and came back to life and searching for keywords in that way.
Which has to be frustrating, because I'm sure everybody has their own verbiage for that.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. So, And one account might say return to the body, and the other one might say left the body or whatever. So even searching for key words can be pretty.
Oh, you still there? Because we got a loud.
Yeah.
Okay, we had a pop there. I wasn't sure, because sometimes you start hearing noises and, well, only bad things happen. So... talk to me about this research process, not problem. Well, I guess it is a problem, but we kind of cleared it up. How do you get your hands on the materials to even start thinking about doing all this stuff? I know the internet's great, but I'm sure it's only a small percentage.
Yeah, it really depends on what the actual case is. So, for example, with the ancient Egyptian stuff, those texts have been translated and retranslated since the 19th century. So, what I did with that, for example, is looking at the most recent translations And just isolating the parts of the text that talk specifically about dying and leaving the body and what happens afterwards. And I sort of did that with all the other ancient stuff. A lot of that was, in some sense, I wouldn't say easier, but fairly straightforward, because just finding their beliefs in an afterlife and then is the main difficulty. And then once you found that, just kind of teasing it out. But for the ancient Indian texts, it was difficult because there are references to near-death experiences in medical texts, for example. In ancient China, there's references in like historical documentary texts that had political purposes. Like they would say that this particular general died and went to the other world, and he met the Shangdi, the creator of heaven, and this deity basically sanctioned his rule back on Earth. So they would use it for these kind of political purposes. So finding the text in all these different areas can be a little difficult. But fortunately, if you search hard enough, you'll find academic texts, articles of people who have kind of been there before. They might not have talked about them in terms of near-death experience, but in Chinese studies, for example, they will say return from death experiences, which is essentially the same thing.
Well, it's close enough that you could figure it out.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And then from there, it's just a matter of looking at their sources and seeing if there are translations and hunting those down. And that's part of the difficulty is there's I'm sure tons and tons of stuff out there that hasn't been translated. So with all the NDEs around the world that I have found, I don't even want to think about how many more I haven't, just from not having not being able to speak 15 or 20 languages.
Well, that's going to be frustrating. No, you'll get there. No, but you mentioned the indigenous, and I'm thinking about all the tribes from Maine down to Florida, and right. They spread out across the West, and they're different. I mean, wildly different beliefs, and mm-hmm. their lack of, I'll say it this way, the promotion of oral storytelling, the handing down of stories orally. So I can't imagine how much stuff just was lost that way. And then what you're trying to find is kind of would be the last thing they'd write down, I'd imagine.
Yeah. Well, that's where the fortunate but also unfortunate thing of missionaries comes in, because missionaries did, as probably everybody knows, they didn't do a lot of good for the Native American population, for example. And neither did the early explorers who came in. But because part of their agenda was to convert Native American peoples, they needed to understand what their afterlife beliefs were. So, despite what they thought about them, they, in a lot of cases, actually did record examples of Native American afterlife beliefs. And often this included the Native American people saying, so the missionary would say, what do you believe about the afterlife? And they would give a whole description of it. And then the missionary would say, and how did you come across this ridiculous information? Because they were always, very hostile and critical to them. And the Native Americans would say, this particular person 3 years ago died on this date and came back to life and told us. And that's exactly how we know. So what's interesting about that is that even though the missionaries were trying to use their information against them, it often had the opposite effect. And the Native Americans would say, we actually don't believe your description of hell because our people have been there and we have firsthand experience of it. So what you're telling us is some guy who lived how many tens of thousands miles away in a culture that we know nothing about. And you're trying to tell us that that's has more bearing on reality than our beliefs. So it was this prioritizing of personal experience within their culture over the foreign Christian ideas, which I think is really interesting.
I'm just sitting here fascinated by the thoughts of trying to do that, convert. Mm-hmm. I mean, just anybody who has never, who's lived in a bubble, for the lack of a better explanation for the time period we have here, somebody new comes in and tells them whatever they're doing is wrong, but they have no context to base their decision off what's worked for them for the last thousands of years. And some guy comes in and says, you're not doing that right. You're not believing right, which is even harder for me to believe.
Yeah.
It's just.
Yeah. And especially when, like I said, they've got people who actually say that that they went there. And the people who were alive, who were around them, saw that person apparently die, and then saw them come back to life, which in itself is going to be a miracle. So obviously they're going to listen to that person and take seriously what they say, because, you know, coming back to life isn't a daily occurrence. And then some, you know, angry foreign missionary comes ridiculing them and saying this is preposterous. It took a while for them to, you know, embrace Christianity, and, you know, many still haven't.
And this Germantown runner, he's on fire tonight. We've got to watch out for him. are there claims from other cultures or our culture for those who have experienced the near-death experience and gained skills like a language, musicality? I think I said that right. The ability to play music or other strange knowledge.
Yeah, that's really a cross-cultural phenomenon. In fact, there was an interesting one from medieval Europe. I think it was English, may have been French. Sorry, I have tons of these in my head. But this guy, a medieval monk, died and came back to life and claimed that he had the ability of omnilingualism, which is the ability to speak all languages. And he didn't speak any foreign languages when he died. So that's interesting. But then in a lot of Native American examples, and also in the Pacific and African societies, they often will come back with some kind of medicinal knowledge, like you need this particular kind of herb to crush up in order to fix the illness that you died of, or to help the plague that's currently decimating your people, or whatever. So it's often some kind of new knowledge or some kind of new ritual. The ghost dance is a lot of people have heard of this. It's a Native American ritual dance that people did to kind of commune with spirits in the other world. That was supposedly learned by somebody in a near-death experience, or actually a few different Native Americans had near-death experiences and brought back very similar types of ritual dances. And that was intended basically for them to bring on the experience in anybody. So it was, you know, democratizing the afterlife. Whoever wanted to do this dance, which involves sometimes drug use or dancing to the point of exhaustion and you collapse with the idea in your mind that you're going to have an NDE-like experience, it would kind of, you know, they bring it about in that way. So it's kind of like making NDEs available to everybody without having to die.
Well, I was thinking about the Sweat Lodge phenomena where they put you in a tent or somewhere and you just crank up that fire until you start seeing things too.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's actually, you know, going back to the idea about some cultures not being friendly to NDEs, there's a really interesting contrast between a lot of the Native American cultures and a lot of the African cultures. Because with Native Americans, like you said, they had things like the Sweat Lodge and Vision Quest. They had different religions that were based on dreams and all kinds. They were really open and interested in these kind of phenomena of otherworld journeys. And a lot of their shamanism was focused on the shaman sending their soul out of the body to the other world to rescue somebody who was dying. So they would send their soul after the soul of somebody else. So they were open to it. So when NDEs came along, they would be, you know, pretty friendly to the person who had it, and they would listen to what they had to say. But there's a really interesting contrast in a lot of African societies where their religion and their beliefs and practices were a lot more focused on ancestor spirits who remained on Earth, and they would live, you know, in the woods or in a river or whatever, these kind of animistic spirits. And they sometimes they get angry and, you know, cause mischief, and it could be malevolent or they could be benevolent. So the kind of religion was built around placating these spirits or keeping them at bay, depending on the situation. So because of that, there grew a fear that there was a lot of fears of sorcery and witchcraft. So if somebody came back to life, they would think that that person, not that they came back to life, but they'd been possessed either by an evil spirit, an ancestor spirit, or that they were a victim of sorcery or witchcraft, that some kind of witch or sorcerer had actually turned them into a zombie effectively. So instead of, you know, rushing to their side and saying, you know, "Oh, Auntie Margie, I'm so happy to see you came back," they would start throwing rocks at them and you know, try to drive them away or even kill them. And that's reflected even in their funerary practices. They would often bind corpses hand and feet and then pile rocks on top of the grave and just basically prevent them from coming back in the first place. And that's why there are very few examples of near-death experience accounts from these African societies. And that's going back to, you know, I went back to 16th century or something up until the 1940s or 50s.
I'm sitting here thinking that's fascinating. You have a near-death experience, you wake up, you're happy to be alive, and then there are people trying to kill you.
Yeah, but that even that is such a different cultural thing, because there are examples of African people who had near-death experiences, came back to life, and then asked to be killed again, essentially. There was a woman who was a victim of human sacrifice in a society called the Akrapong people. And she came back and said, I went to the other world and I met this council of gods, and they said, you're naked. What are you doing here naked? This is, you know, disrespectful. So she said they sent me back in order to get some clothes on to you know, properly present myself to them. And so they said, okay, and they brought her some clothes and she got dressed and she's like, okay, I'm ready now. And they you know, quote unquote, killed her again. So it was a very different attitude towards death in the afterlife than what we have.
I'll be the ignorant one at this moment. This does not reflect your opinion at all, but can you imagine sending your guards out to kill somebody and then they come back in and be like, tell you this story? You know, they expected you to be dead, and then they come in and tell you the story, and then you have to send them back out there to finish the job.
I know, yeah. and you know, what's interesting about this is that those kinds of beliefs and attitudes, they withheld even through Christian conversion. There were some examples from 80s or early 2000s even, I can't remember. But a couple examples of in the Congo of people who came back to life, and these, you know, modernized societies essentially, who came back to life, and all of the relatives at the deathbed just fled in fear. And it took the person, the NDE, a little while to convince them, like, no, it's actually me. And fortunately, you know, it's you know, modern times, and nothing happened to them. They eventually did listen, but the initial impulse was, you know, to get the hell away from there. Even and then when they listen to the person's NDE, it's very similar to, you know, different ones in different societies. So the actual experience the person's having doesn't really reflect necessarily on how the culture reacts to it.
This is a speculative question from Germantown Runner, which like I said, he's on fire tonight. He should be the one hosting the show tonight, apparently. since NDAs are always unexplained, can future technology be planned for, like, cryogenics for a form of near-death experience? Like, I can't imagine giving yourself a near-death experience on purpose, but I guess, well, technology is probably going to get there.
Yeah, I actually wouldn't be surprised if people do it already. And people do say that, like, ketamine and DMT drug experiences, and ayahuasca too, that they are very similar to near-death experiences. Some of the examples of NDEs I found in some of the indigenous cultures might have actually been the shamanic types of experiences. They might actually have been real NDEs, because they would say things like, you know, they would take so many drugs of whatever type of drug it was that they would pass out dead, and everybody around them would think that they were dead, and then they'd come back to life. And sometimes they would even say that the shaman burned himself to death or clubbed himself to death. So, you know, our definition of death might be different for one thing. but another thing is, I even though there's no way of being able to determine, you know, how dead people in the past might have been in these experiences, I think if somebody's clubbing themselves senseless to the point that everybody around them thinks is dead, we could probably kind of consider that an NDE.
I was going to say, so, I mean, it's a sliding scale, right? Because the ability to medically bring them back is far different, too.
Yeah, absolutely. So, and which might have made them seem even more kind of miraculous before there was, you know, good medical technology. But yeah, I mean, there's also attempts at making virtual reality NDEs. A couple of people have done, like, you know, you put on the VR glasses and you have this 3D NDE, but as far as you know, a mainstream thing of people, of doctors medically inducing them, yeah, I don't know. That would be a difficult ethics thing for them to get around, I think, unless they could prove that there was no physical danger to the person. And even then, you know, the way drugs are regulated, it seems like something like that would be fairly regulated.
And then the horrible follow-up question, would you have one if we got to the point where you could safely medically?
You know, I probably would if it was safe, but there would be a big part of me thinking, I know this is artificially induced, and therefore I don't know if this is a real experience or if it's more like just a drug experience. And that's where I have a little bit of skepticism about the drug experience NDE equation. Because just because a ketamine trip or whatever can be very similar to an NDE, it doesn't mean that it's actually fundamentally the same thing or even anything like it.
Ooh, that's a deep point there. Because, yeah. I mean, we've all, well, I guess we all, I can't say that. Several of us, is that fair? Have had those drunken visions, right? Where we've had a little too much to drink. And
right.
So, which we normally don't have.
I've done, you know, psilocybin and psychedelics in the past, you know, when I was younger. And there was, even if I was seeing, I don't know, whatever, God in the moon, part of me knew that, you know, no, I'm just tripping. and I knew that it wasn't really real. So I think if, in contrast, if I had an NDE and I saw my body lying there and I was outside my body and had some kind of genuinely evidential thing, I think that would be a very different prospect than knowing that I had taken a drug, I think. But then again, people who take especially ayahuasca, they're absolutely convinced that these entities they encounter or whatever were 100% real.
Shifting Gears brought to you by evergreenpodcast.com. Shifting Gears brought to you by evergreenpodcast.com. So you've been researching this for a long time and you've covered the world in these different beliefs. How has it changed you personally?
I'm not totally sure that it has all that much. I think it's made me realize what I already knew, which is that there's a lot of things I don't know. And that I don't think that, for one thing, I don't think anybody, even people who have NDEs and come back and tell you what it's like to die, I don't think anybody knows exactly what it's like for you to die or for me to die. I think everybody's going to have a somewhat different experience, partly depending on your culture and your individuality or whatever. It hasn't really convinced me that there's an afterlife, but it definitely hasn't convinced me that there's not. So I guess I just kind of, I got to a point where I'm okay with that ambivalence and just kind of thinking I'll find out when the time comes. what is actually going to happen?
Well, when the time, well, you're going to have to communicate. We'll have to figure this out.
Yeah, which is a whole other area of afterlife stuff.
Yeah, I was going to say, that's a whole fun can of worms, too. But is there a commonality between all these different visions of what people are seeing in the afterlife? Because, you know, we all have the, again, the rainbows and unicorns vision of the good side of the afterlife and the fiery pits of hell, I'll say it,
yeah.
Right? But is that common, or is that just the Christian coming out in me?
It's really interesting, actually, because as far as near-death experiences go, there are negative, distressing NDEs that people have, but they're pretty rare. I can't remember the percentage, but it's tiny, less than 1%. And when people do have them, they seem to often be one of two things. One is that they're very confusional and that they're very unlike regular NDEs. So they just say, you know, it was just blackness and I felt like there was figures dragging me down and they don't wake up with this kind of clarity and it doesn't stay with them for the rest of their lives and change their lives and all these other things that regular NDEs do.
I was going to say, I'm just going to interrupt you there for a minute because I would have thought that number would have been much higher, 50-50 even. You know, I had this vision of burning in the pit and say, you know, I better get my my shit together and turn my life around.
Yeah, it's not that. I mean, there are, you know, evangelical Christian NDE studies that say that they're higher. Maybe it's 2%. I don't know.
Well, you're still not.
yeah, but it's still not very high. And then some of them seem to be very similar to the you know, traditional NDE or whatever you want to call them. But they're experienced in a negative way. So they'll see they'll go through darkness and they'll see it as threatening, and they'll meet a being of light and think that it's oppressive. And the whole thing is just they're terrified, but it's still basically the same types of experiences. But as far as actual beliefs around the world goes, most cultures around the world do have some kind of judgment or negative and positive afterlife beliefs. But what I think is the case is that, at least I observe this in China and India and Egypt, that the more religion in general, but afterlife beliefs in particular, become sort of popularized and disseminated through society and less particularly for the elite, you know, the kings and the priests, the more they become kind of manipulated, it seems. Like there's more emphasis on hell and punishments and this binary good-evil kind of behavior and afterlife thing. Whereas in earlier times, it's a lot less of that. So what I think was going on was a tool of social control, really, that the more people were able to control other people with this promise of heaven and the threat of hell, the more they exploited it. And so the descriptions of, you know, being boiled in a pot or having your fingernails taken out or whatever become almost lovingly described in some of these later Chinese and Indian and Egyptian texts when they just didn't really exist earlier on. And I think that's, you know, probably what's going on with Christianity too. Interesting thing about Christianity is it's a religion that's based on the death and return of, you know, one particular person, but there aren't really that many NDEs coming out of Christianity. There's none in the Old Testament or in the New Testament, which I find surprising. And I think that's also a political kind of official Orthodox theology thing, that the staple of Christianity is the way to heaven and the way to God is through Christ and only through Christ. So if they were to say, popularize the idea that people have near-death experiences, then people would be saying, wait, you mean I can get there without Christ? I can get there by dying myself. Everybody can be Christ and die in return. So I think that's also some kind of a, you know, manipulation of what may or may not have happened.
Circling back to our previous question about doing it on purpose, I mean, I guess that would become a major problem.
Yeah, if you sure. could.
Oh boy. So you, what about East versus West? Because we, you know, the Buddhism and that versus, well, we're kind of hashed on Christianity. But what about Buddhism and that? How does that work with all this?
Yeah, that's there are a few things. So going back to the idea of what's similar across cultures, so just very generally, like leaving the body obviously is cross-culturally universal, because otherwise there wouldn't be anybody to tell us about their NDEs. Leaving the body, entering darkness, light, and encountering some kind of spirit beings, and then being told to return and returning to the body. Those are kind of the main general themes. But then within that, there are a lot of differences. And so one of them, for example, is the near-death experiences you might be familiar with. Somebody is told, no, you need to go back to your body because you need to take care of your children, or you need to fulfill some, you know, work that you were doing on Earth, or you need to change and become a better person. There's always some kind of, you know, developmental or educational motivation for it. But in a lot of other societies, in China, for example, and some small-scale societies, sometimes in India, the reason they're sent back is because it was a case of mistaken identity, basically. So they'd say, you know, we got the wrong Jim Malliard. We want the one who lives, you know, outside of London or whatever. So they would send you back to your body, and they'd go and grab the other one.
Clerical errors. That's always good.
Yeah. So obviously being sent back to the body and returning to the body is the same, but the reason for it, you know, seems to depend on culture. And then another very interesting cultural difference is a lot of small-scale tribal societies, they describe walking along a road to the other world, and they'll even say, you know, as I was walking along the path, I saw other footprints of the hundreds of souls that had walked to the other world before me. Very rarely do they say they went rushing through a tunnel in darkness. So, but obviously the theme is the same. They're going from one place, you know, an earthly realm in the spirit form to get to another part of the afterlife realm. So yeah, there's certain things that seem to be determined by culture and religion and belief, but then certain things, more general things, that aren't. And it's unpacking all that and trying to find out what everybody has and what everybody hasn't is I think at this point not going to happen, because there's so much diversity between them. And that's one of the things that makes them both fascinating but frustrating, because from the earliest times of NDE studies in the 70s, they were, even Raymond Moody's first book, he's trying to figure out what is universal about NDEs. And he was looking at, you know, an example from ancient Greece and a couple medieval ones, and nobody's been able to figure that out. And I just think it's not going to happen, because there's all these different elements that each different person draws upon. So they're similar, but they're different.
Even documenting the current day beliefs would be difficult, let alone historically.
Yeah, absolutely. And then documenting, you know, subjective personal experiences is even more complicated, because we also don't know when somebody comes back from an NDE. You know, they often will say, "Oh, it all happened at once," or it's difficult to explain. But then they explain it, and in the explaining of it, they kind of create a narrative which may not have happened in the order that they said, or they might be using symbols or imagery to explain something that's unexplainable. So it's a difficult thing to unpack.
Just like my wife, she'll tell me something that's in a certain color, I'll be like, put it in the 8 crayon box for me, so yeah. I can understand.
Yeah, exactly. We all perceive things totally differently when we're in our bodies. So. Yeah.
And she doesn't like me when I do that. You mean red? No, I mean maroon. No, red. I guess this probably has some, maybe this is a not in your pay grade or in your realm of study, but I'm sitting here thinking about, because, you know, I kicked around the idea of being cremated. Of course, now you're telling me about all these people coming back to their body, right? And now I'm revisiting this whole notion in my head while you're talking about all of this, because if I ash myself, there'll be no body for me to come back to. So how does that, that's got to play a factor in some of these burial traditions around the world, right?
Yeah, for sure. In societies that are more open to NDEs, and they know about them and they kind of accept them as part of their beliefs, their burial practices involve not burying the body for, you know, 5 or 6 days or 7 days, depending on, I guess, the climate, you know, like how quickly a corpse would decay in whatever climate they're in. But the point being that they give the person ample time to return to the body, and it's only when the corpse is basically beyond the state of being able to house a person in it, that only then would they bury it or cremate it.
But don't the Jewish people bury people by the sunrise of the next, or a sunset of the next day?
Yeah, so they're, and you know, there aren't very many NDEs known from Judaism, and they're don't appear in the Hebrew Bible. The only time they crop up is in mystical Kabbalah traditions, and even there, they're often, you know, a little bit vague as to whether it's an NDE or mysticism. So yeah, that's there's a real correlation between burial practices and, you know, the existence of reports of NDEs in different cultures.
Why? Now that I've said it out loud, of course there is, but these things that rattle through my mind backwards and slowly.
Yeah. So if you wait long enough, you know, if you make sure that enough time has passed, you're probably safe being cremated. But, you know, in Victorian times, they had that fear, and they had a string leading into the coffin attached to a bell in case they woke up after being buried, which is
Maybe I should get a bell and be cremated. That'd just be fun.
Yeah, just to be just
to make people wonder.
Yeah.
So you've been doing this research for years. Is there one particular thing that you just, anytime you talk about this stuff, that never gets brought up, but you just always love talking about?
Oh, wow, that's a good question. No, I guess, you know, one of the things, I guess partly what got me interested in this in the first place was the similarities between the ancient afterlife beliefs and NDEs. And I was kind of looking at this idea of cross-cultural similarity in all these different cultures. And that's what my first book was, which was called Conceptions of the Afterlife in Early Civilizations. It's actually going to be called Near-Death Experience in Ancient Civilizations. So in a couple of years, it's going to be reissued. But basically, so that was interesting, I enjoyed doing that research. But it was really later that the differences stood out to me more and started just kind of in a way capturing my imagination more, as well as the more kind of, I mean, what I've been talking about so far is all pretty cultural history of religions kind of stuff. But as far as like going into the psychical research and parapsychology stuff, you know, what are the implications for all this stuff on that side of things? You know, what does it mean for the idea that near-death experiences are actual experiences of an afterlife? And at the same time, what does it mean for claims that they're just the dying brain and, you know, a burst of energy activity at the end of life or whatever? And I think because basically I think my research can be used to support either kind of theory. But in some ways, it's a real challenge to the materialist theories, to the idea that it's just the dying brain. For example, there was a recent study, a couple of recent studies, there was that they detected that rats, when they're dying, have this burst of brain activity at the last few moments of death. And then they observed that in a human. They were able to, in just last year, they monitored a person who was dying and confirmed that there's this huge burst of brain activity right when somebody dies. And so they said, so that's probably explains the life review element of an NDE. And there are all these, you know, overblown reports in the media that NDEs have been explained by physical science. But the issue there is that they're only looking at the popular conception, the Western popular conception of Western NDEs. They're not taking into account the fact that life reviews are completely, practically unknown in a lot of the small scale societies. And they're actually quite rare, even in the West. So they've taken this like stereotype generality that you'd see in a movie, and they've said, oh, that explains this one element, when that element isn't universal in itself. So in other words, they're saying a universal brain-based function explains this universal near-death experience thing, but the near-death experience thing isn't universal to begin with.
Well, I'm sitting here thinking, okay, so you have your replay of life version of a near-death experience, or your death experience, if you were, versus the people that visit the afterlife. Well, that's two different trains on two different tracks. Right. And if the person comes back and has one without the other, either or, that still doesn't explain the one.
Exactly. Yeah. So any kind of physiological explanation that they've so far come up with isn't holding water. I'm not saying that they won't come up with one that does, but so far they haven't. But then, you know, by the same token, you could say that the similarities that do exist cross-culturally show that it's some kind of maybe cognitive function of the brain, maybe not a totally physical thing, but just the way our cognitive mechanisms work, and that then it's overlaid with you know, the particular cultural stuff. Like there's a neuroscientist researcher, Jesse Baring, who demonstrated that very, very young children who basically had no religion, and this is in the West, in England and in America, that they intuitively believed in an afterlife even before they had even been taught about it. They would give them a puppet show where a lizard puppet is killed by another puppet, and they'd say, "What happened to that puppet?" And none of them would just say, "Oh, he's dead," and in the ground they'd say, "He went to see his mother," or, you know, whatever. They would make up some scenario to show that that puppet somehow had an afterlife. So for whatever reason, we seem to be intuitively, you know, we're hardwired to believe in an afterlife, which is in itself pretty interesting.
I was going to say, of all the things you've said tonight, I think that one. Maybe. I don't want to downplay the rest of it, but we're 15 minutes in, and that's kind of the first time you've kind of left me go, "Oh, wait a second."
Yeah, and so then if we're primed to believe in an afterlife, then when people have NDEs and come back, we're sort of primed to accept what they say about it and accept that what they said, you know, really was an experience of an afterlife. Which and the same goes with, you know, mediumship stuff and reincarnation, which I also talk about in the new book. It's a similar kind of, you know, there's an intuitive thing to be open about it. And even skeptical scientists, they wouldn't be researching it and trying to disprove it if they weren't interested in it. So,
yeah, you've got to believe enough to want to disprove it, that there's something there, because you're trying to disprove it, which is always fascinating to me. What also makes me wonder what children know or believe, or however you want to frame that, that we kind of learn out of them by teaching them all with stuff we know.
Yeah. Yeah. And especially, I mean, there's a lot of cases of, you probably have knowledge of some of these children who remember past lives, who, you know, from the age of 2 or even younger, they start saying, "I want to go see my other mommy in this other country or other city or whatever." And these have been investigated by psychiatrists and other types of investigators. And some of them have been able to match up the personality that the kid is talking about, you know, their past personality, to an actual person who historically lived. And the kid will be able to give directions to the house and talk about, you know, they'll meet relations that they used to have, relatives, and know about their work and how the person died and all this other stuff. And that's really difficult to explain in, you know, in scientific terms. Either it's being made up, or there really is reincarnation, or the kid is picking up some kind of, you know, psychic consciousness residue out in the universe that's totally unexplainable. But it's, you know, it's unusual stuff. And to my mind, hasn't been, again, totally proven or totally disproven.
It's fascinating stuff. So, okay. What advice would you give somebody who is headed down a spiritual, I'll just keep it broad, base of research?
I would say a couple things. I guess it depends on, you know, if they're within a university kind of setting, if they're doing it through a formal education. I would say, depending on what kind of department you're in, think about doing something else first until you get your tenured post in a university. If you are trying to apply for a university lectureship or something, and you have near-death experience and mediumship and spiritualism and stuff like
appearing
that.
Appearing on the Maurer Report. No.
it might not do you any favors. So, I would say consider being firmly into the mainstream first before you embark on it. But if you don't care about those things, then I would say, nevertheless, do it through mainstream education through a university, so you can get that critical thinking that I think is difficult to develop outside of the university context, and also the, you know, just the basic research methods of finding your sources and analyzing them and all these kinds of things that that higher education does well. They don't do everything well, but training and basic research and critical thinking, I think, are important things.
Wait just a minute here. YouTube and Wikipedia are not critical thinking and not good sources for research?
especially not Wikipedia. No,
I am
Wikipedia
wildly disappointed.
Notorious bias against anything like this. there was a reference to me in their article about afterlife beliefs around the world or something, and some Wikipedia editor went in there and changed historian of religions Gregory Shushan. They changed it to parapsychologist because apparently they thought that would be more demeaning, and my, you know, what I'm saying would be less taken less seriously than if I have a real PhD from a real university. So.
Which you do. Like I said, I refuse to read that whole list because we would still be probably reading it. Okay, maybe it's not quite that wrong, but it's impressive, which is why I'm thrilled to have you here. Okay, so we've got 4 minutes left, so we kind of, first, where can people find you? And then we'll lighten up because I've got a few little fun questions for you.
Sure. Yeah, I'm all over the social medias, Gregory Shushan. I have a website, gregoryshushan.com. I should also mention, actually, people might be interested. There's a publisher in the UK called White Crow Books, and they published all kinds of things on life after death and these kinds of areas. And I've started my own imprint with them called Afterworlds Press. And in that, I'm publishing books by various other authors and kind of resurrecting a lot of books that, you know, haven't been seen since they went out of print in the 50s or whatever. There's one example. There's a book about Native American afterlife beliefs written by a Swedish scholar, which is great. And it was only published in this small press edition in 1957. And now people can just, you know, buy it online on Amazon. There's also a great one that we just published. You probably know the Parapsychology Foundation and the medium Eileen Garrett, really famous medium. Yeah. And she kept getting these, you know, channelings and communications from this entity throughout her life who told her that his name was Lucifer. And she wrote down all of these communications from him and also wrote a kind of psychological self-portrait of what and how was going on with her communications with this, because she was really skeptical of it. So this is like a long-lost manuscript that the president of the Parapsychology Foundation, Lizette Coley, she unearthed this in the family archives, and so we've just published that. It's called Call Me Lucifer. So if anyone's interested in that stuff, it's on afterworldspress.com.
We'll have to have you back and talk about all that stuff. Because, well, I knew we weren't going to get through everything tonight, so that's why I kind of zeroed in because, well, we were talking about the inch wide, mile deep thing earlier, me and you. I'd rather go the mile deep instead of the inch. Yeah, anyways.
I'll also just say I'm an independent scholar, which means I'm doing this for more love than money. So I've got a Patreon account. So if anyone is interested in supporting me on Patreon, that's just, again, Patreon.com/Gregory Shushan. And you can, you know, start at $1 a month or whatever. And there's free books. And I do the historical NDE of the month that people get in their email and all kinds of cool stuff.
So last question, the most difficult question of the night. You ready?
Sure.
What's your favorite breakfast?
Favorite breakfast. I don't know. I'm probably going to be, I was about to be boring and say cereal, but it's actually a very New Mexico thing. I'm in Santa Fe, New Mexico, and there's blue corn pancakes with pinon nuts and real maple syrup.
Ooh, sounds like something I have to try because that sounds delicious.
Yeah, it's really good.
Well, hey, I thank you for blowing my mind several times tonight. Like I said, I'll bring you back. We'll talk about the publishing and all those. There's so much there as well.
But great. Thanks, Jim. Yeah.
And have a good evening. I guess it's evening now over there, so I'm right.
Yeah.
Talk to you soon.
All right. Well, thanks for having me on.
And there we go. And, yeah. Wow. Yeah, it does sound good, doesn't it, Jim Tanner? I'm excited because that's normally if he would have went cereal, I would have had to been asking follow ups to that. And I don't like doing that, but man, sounds good. Yeah, Kat, very interesting tonight. So I'm glad we went there. And I definitely have to get him back on to talk about all that other stuff. Oh man, that's what I get when I get good people. It's just remarkable. So be looking for him to come back around because, man, we barely scratch the surface of what he's been into throughout his life. So, Yeah, so we're digging through January here. I hope everybody's staying warm and staying well. Sending some love to our good friend WR250 as well. He's got a lot going on in his personal life. We're not going to divulge any details in any of that, but just throw one up for him tonight or whenever you're listening to this, because he needs it. And yeah, we'll take care of business. See you next week.
It's the Mallard Report. Yeah, the Mallard Report.
Hey, I want to thank you for joining us. It's been a good show tonight. I hope you enjoyed it. Take a few moments, subscribe, share, all the fun stuff. You know how to do it. I don't have to tell you. Just be ready for next week. It'll be sooner than you think.
Hello, everyone. My name is Tom Kearns, and I host the Anglo-Saxon England podcast, where I cover the history and culture of England from the departure of the Romans in the 5th century to the Norman conquest in 1066. So far, we've surveyed the collapse of Roman rule in Britain, the migration of the Anglo-Saxons, and the history of Northumbria from its beginnings in the mists of legend to its destruction at the hands of Viking raiders in the 9th century. I hope you'll come and give it a go.